Giuliano, what's your favorite thing about cafes?
About cafes?
Yes.
The cafe, as in the coffee. That's usually my favorite thing.
The coffee itself?
Yes.
That's quite predictable.
Yeah.
Well, for myself, I'd say it's probably those nice table books they put up. And nicely enough, today we'll talk about a book which I personally would love to have on my coffee table. The Science Basement! Hello and welcome to the Science Basement Podcast, a podcast for those who love all things science. I'm your host for today, Anastasia, joined by my amazing co-host, Giuliano.
Hello!
And our guest for today is a group leader in the field of mitochondrial research, a professional in microscopy and imaging, and a book author, Christopher Jackson. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Anastasia. Thank you for having me.
Welcome, welcome. Well, Chris has just published his new book called Micro. And I must say, it's more than just a coffee table book, like referencing to what we just introduced a few moments ago.
Great connection, Anastasia.
Thank you.
Great connection.
Thank you. I'll give myself a little star. We'll talk about more about the book in a few moments. But Chris, maybe you could introduce yourself now for our listeners.
So my day job is researching at the University of Helsinki. And my main passion is microscopy, which I hope to introduce you to here.
This is interesting because microscopy, I've heard the word in the academic field as a profession or an expertise. As a hobby, it's the first time I hear it. So I'm very excited and curious about this.
Yeah, it's nice that you would say that it's a hobby. So basically, we use it obviously as a research tool, originally coming from the Greek and just meaning seeing the small things. So that is what it's doing. And it started out with basically having the ability to make good lenses of crystal at the beginning. So this is where it all started.
But wasn't it the way microscope first appeared was just a little hole? Was it in a piece of paper or something like that?
Yeah, so that's the camera obscura probably you're talking about. No, so it's mainly they started out to just getting lenses into magnifying glasses. That's where it started out.
I didn't know that much. But for people who may not be familiar, because of course both myself and Giuliano are biologists and we know sort of the basics, could you maybe like briefly explain the principle of microscopy and actually what types of microscopy even are there? Because surely people have seen images of different kinds, but it's very interesting to know how they're even produced.
Yeah, so interestingly, it all starts out with waves and what we can basically perceive. So whatever is microscopic and uses light microscopy is based on the wavelengths you can see, which range from roughly 400 to 700 nanometers. And that is what we call visible light. But of course, it's a mixed different colors of light, so the different wavelength. And this is what in the end will make up the visible light you can perceive with your eyes. But of course, everything else is waves as well. So what you're hearing now or our audience is hearing is just other type of waves, which we can hear using our ears. And which for example, for radio ranges in the range of 0.1 to 17 meters.
Wow.
So the visible light we are seeing is really a tiny spectrum.
Well, in your work then, do you use light microscopes only?
Yeah, so in essence, we use light microscope, but more advanced techniques basically use single wavelength, which is similar to a laser for which you can basically have advanced imaging techniques to look at that. And then, of course, we are limited with the wavelengths of light to a certain resolution. So in order to get higher resolutions, we need to change to other media, which is electrons, which have a really, really short wavelength. And that is where you can basically zoom in and get into the dimensions we are interested in.
But in a nutshell, you would use, for example, like a light microscope to see some bigger structures and then electron microscope to really to even smaller ones, like to zoom in even more.
Yes. So with the light microscope, we're able to go down to a couple of nanometers. And what that means is basically that we can see a tenth or one hundredth of a millimeter. And after that, we have certain physical limitations, which sort of make it impossible to go closer and or separate dots. And that is where electrons come in, which unfortunately, if you want to use electrons, you need to have a microscope which works under vacuum. And one issue there is that with biological samples, they don't fare well under vacuum because they have water. So for these type of preparations, you need to fix the samples and sort of dehydrate it, especially to sort of keep the ultrastructure intact.
I mean, the whole machine for electron microscopy is usually quite bulky and requires like a whole vacuum and all things like that. But maybe we will not go too much deep into the details of the technicalities of those things. Though I quite personally really like electron microscopy, though it's more hard to interpret than light microscopy. It looks more like a black and white soup of things, but it's interesting in its own way. And it's a very powerful tool. But speaking of the soup and black and white images, what many people don't realize when they're looking at the ready-made images from even also light microscopy is that many of the colors are artificially put in there. So how do you yourself like select which color to add? Do you try to go more into like an artistic spectrum and like put some interesting color combinations, or do you try to make it more realistic how it most likely is in nature?
Good question. So essentially, when you have a fixed sample for electron microscopy, the signal you will get back is electrons which will be attracted to that sample or not, or reflected. So in essence, you get a grayscale image. And now the interesting part obviously starts, what type of color or what color would that object basically have? And that is not even always clear, because for example, there are butterfly scales which have specific holes which are able to reflect the light in a way that you think it's blue or iridescent, but basically it's not, and you don't know the actual color. Or they have both. They have colored scales and this additional fact that they get this iridescence. So from that point of view, I use colors which I would see and which we see. So we basically transform these dimensions and how they could look as color, but it will, in often cases, it will be false.
Can I say something? I know for sure. And when I say I know for sure, it means that it's a very strong personal opinion that some cell organelles have a specific color because they do. And for example, I'm gonna mention one very famous cell organelle, which is the mitochondria. That for some reason, in my brain, it has to be red. There's no scientific argument for this. And I have discussed this several times with other people who for some reason thought mitochondria should be green, but for some reason, in my brain, mitochondria need to be red. And there's no way I can argue against or in favor of that. It's just so hardwired in my brain. I think it comes from the fact that during my biology studies, my biology, like cell biology book, for some reason printed all the mitochondria, even like the cartoons, you know, in red. So now I learned them that way, but I guess that's just me.
It's lucky that you invited a mitochondrial researcher, because in essence, they're always depicted green.
Why? No, this is so wrong.
For no reason at all. However, the truth is, if you isolate mitochondria from muscle, what you will basically end up with, the really tiny speck you've isolated will be brown. And the reason for it is because it contains iron.
That makes sense, yes. Well, but red is closer to brown than green, if I may say. So I'm kind of more right.
Exactly. It should be okay. Blue reddish.
Thank you.
Fully agreed.
We can tell people from the Mitochondria Awareness Week to change the color from green to red, because it's more scientifically correct.
Exactly, because we did have a Mitochondria Awareness Week episode and we had to have it green. And I was so annoyed. Yes, and now I have a scientific argument. They contain iron.
But lighting up something in brown, yeah, it doesn't really work.
Yeah, you're right.
So Chris, let me just use this whole discussion as a segue into actually discussing your book, And so what is your book even about?
In essence, I have been microscoping so many things and which accumulated to thousands, ten thousands of images, which I felt at some point when you show them to people, they sort of like it.
They can be very beautiful. They can be very beautiful, yes.
One researcher I was working together was looking into this unicellular parasite in blood, and he sort of has never seen it in that resolution, just sort of provided him the image with, which then actually made a cover figure. So people like to see what they are working with. Over the collecting all these images over the years, I sort of felt that I wanted to make the essence of that into one book.
No, I can totally see how that would make a beautiful... I presume there's a lot of pictures, right? I don't think there's any point in making a microscopy book without pictures. So I presume there's a lot of pictures and photographs. Now, this is something that I always ask anyone who I hear writes a book, because, you know, I think everyone has thought at least once to, oh, I want to write a book about this topic. How do you start? So you have... I'm going to write a book about this. You open your laptop, you open Word, I guess. And then what? How do you start writing a book?
Good question. So in essence, I tried to categorize all my thousands of images and found no other way than basically having three parts, which was one, the crystallization of chemicals, which make these beautiful abstract images, the classical light microscopy, which is familiar to many people, and then the electron microscopy, which needs digital coloring. And that is where the three parts in the book sort of made a whole.
So what are the three parts called?
Yeah, I actually have it in front of me, the book, which you can hear.
I can't. I can't hear it.
You can't hear it.
It's very good noise cancellation, I guess.
So the first part is called crystals, where I have crystallized all the chemicals we also use in the lab, or basically eat, vitamins, food preservatives, things like that. And the second one is called light, because there we only use the method of light microscopy. And the third one is called electron, where we have the electron microscopic images.
Makes sense with the naming of the chapters, categories.
Pretty yeah. Fair titling, I'd say. Yeah, straight to the point. Yeah.
I just wanted to say that a lot of the stuff that you put basically comes from your extensive experience in the microscopy. And it feels to me that it's really a perfect timing for people to start writing a book once they've already gained some experience and accumulated so much of it that they can actually share and tell people about. I just wanted to comment on this.
And I think this would come, this connects well with my next question, because yes, I agree. Like, once you gain a certain level of experience, then you feel the interest to show to other people the beauties of what you do. However, I can imagine that a lot of the things one does are beautiful. Other things may not be as beautiful, or may not be as beautiful to a non-expert eye. So, okay, you mentioned that you have these three parts, like the crystals, light, so light microscopy, and pictures from the electron microscopy. But I'm sure you didn't put there every single picture you did in your career. That would be impossible. So how do you choose the things that a non-expert audience would at least appreciate? How do you choose this picture goes in, this picture will stay out of it?
So in essence, first I have to say how I generate pictures, or images for that matter, which is basically I want to just explore new things and see new matter crystallizing in front of me if I talk about chemicals. So I will never know how they look until sort of I make crystallize them and take images.
Makes sense.
And choosing them, once started to cut down to the essence of the collection of images I have. And there are not that many images in the book, which basically sort of are connected in some way or another. And that is also why the title of the book is called A Microscopic World in Everything. Because my challenge was to find something where people basically, whatever word or matter or object you sort of come up with, you will have a connection in the book. That's the aim.
Maybe you could give an example?
I can think of one. Salt. Sodium chloride. A crystal.
Sodium chloride. I actually don't have sodium chloride. And the reason is it's crystallizing in a way. It's cubic, so it does not polarize the light in a way that it would give the beautiful images.
This is one way to choose what does not exactly. go into the book, because it doesn't look pretty enough.
You can make anything look pretty. And that is also a point that it's only that you image and that you see and that you see something which is beautiful without sort of having an opinion about it, whether it's good or bad or what it does. But for a salt, of course, for example, I have potassium iodide, which is also a salt. So if we only talk about sodium chloride, that's one type of salt, but everything, mostly things which crystallize are ions and salts. So one is potassium iodide, which is added to table salt in order to sort of prevent diseases which affect...
The thyroid.
Exactly. And which in Switzerland, you get tablets because if there is a nuclear disaster, you should take a high amount because the worst radioactivity actually comes from radioactive iodide.
So what? This salt looks better? The iodide salt looks better than sodium chloride? You were mentioning...
Subjective, isn't it?
No, I know. Because you were mentioning that you added that in the book.
That is true. Probably had... Well, I would say all of the compounds have a really great backstory. So salt would have worked just as well. But yeah, it was a selection process. So I put potassium iodide, which has an interesting backstory as well. And this is also how I wrote the texts accompanying the book, essentially, which on one hand side, you will have the colorful images, which depict some matter or physical matter in the world. And on the other hand side, you sort of have a compiled black and white, because it's written in black, scientific knowledge, but it does not do justice to the image itself.
So you combine beautiful pictures and interesting facts and description of what people are looking at in the picture. I'm loving this already.
Yeah, so that's the connection. But of course, it's also not a criticism, but a play on what positivism has brought out as facts and what I state and what the world looks like, and mocking the technical advancement with which these images have been taken, which we now have access to.
And I really love that it's basically quite similar to even encyclopedia. So it's pictures that visualize the topic, and then you're basically adding very interesting information and facts about what people see. So people can actually learn something new and exciting from the book. It's not about aesthetics and pretty pictures, but it's much more than that.
Yes.
But you may not, like, it's impossible for people to know that much, and especially because what you are presenting there is from many different fields. So how did you find information to write there? Like, you must have read a tons of literature.
Yeah, so one of my main points was to really condense the text. And so you have like the title, you have a catchphrase which basically explains or puts out an interesting fact about this, which should stick to you and which you will never forget. And a text which is condensed, which contains a lot of information, which I have had accumulated from different sources when I was exploring sort of this compound myself. So it was sort of interesting notes, but not fully exhaustive, but basically...
just brief and crisp type of information, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, not a scientific paper, thank God.
So it's not a university textbook about microscopy.
And this is essentially also because it's self-published.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What does it mean, self-published, for people like me who don't know that?
Yeah, so in essence, everything is done by myself, and you sort of get a printing service to do it.
Oh, well, that sounds even harder, the fact that you did everything yourself. But was it really everything, or did you get any help at all?
No, of course, you need a lot of help. So luckily, one of my friends is actually a typesetter who has developed the specific font, not for this book, but in general, it's a font which is between artistic and very technical.
Oh, now I'm curious. I mean, of course, we can't show a specific font in a podcast. But we can get pictures of it, and then we can share it on our social media. I wouldn't ask you to describe verbally how the font looks like. That would be absolutely ridiculous. But I did think of it.
No chance. And then, of course, the graphic design, which was another one of my youth friends, actually, who's doing that.
You have very resourceful friends.
Exactly. But I had no editor, so that I needed to get.
But yeah, I guess aesthetics and like graphical design is not also something that scientists very much think about. It's really good that you got some help from your friends.
That is true. So rarely do scientists think about, when they take images on the microscope, about resolution, how big you can print them, color schemes, all of that. And of course, also the framing of things.
Okay, so apart from the potassium iodide crystals, what other cool stuff can we find in your book? Give us some juicy examples.
Yeah, like I'm sure the listeners would also would like to know, like, what kind of stuff, like what kind of information they can get out of there.
So there are many things in the book which you come about on the everyday, on a daily basis. For example, in your toothpaste, you have an abrasive type of small skeletons which come from diatoms, which are a unicellular organism.
Wait, I have to stop you there. You're telling me there, you mentioned the word skeletons. There are skeletons in my toothpaste.
Exactly. And those are actually silicium dioxide skeletons.
What is silicium?
It's one of the most abundant elements on Earth, which is comes from silicon. Not silicone the rubber, but Silicon Valley. And so these organisms are everywhere. They're in all water bodies, salt and fresh. They even are in the air. They are used in forensics to determine how long water corpses have been lying about, for example, but rarely. And of course, they have really beautiful and intricate skeletons because there are an estimate of around 20,000 to 2 million different type of species. And why they are interesting for the microscopist is because you need a technique which is called focus stacking. And that has to do that the focus plane, when you use microscopy, you cannot get a really good depth of field. So not everything is crisp and in focus. So you need to take 10, 20, 50 images and stack them in order to get a crisp image.
So I'm still processing the information that there are things in my toothpaste. So you mentioned diatoms, right? What? I'm sorry, I'm not going to deep into this. I'm just going to come to peace with it. You said they're unicellular organisms. What are they? Kind of algae?
Yeah, exactly. They're an algae type. And the most amazing fact about them, in essence, is that they produce 20 to 40% of all oxygen.
What? 20 to 40% of the oxygen we have on the planet. Wow. Exactly
right. Just pushing aside all those trees. Like, give us some
okay.
space.
Wow.
Hold my beer.
Okay. Exactly. Hold my beer, Amazon forest. And we can find this. We can find pictures of these things in your book. Okay, now I'm very curious.
Of these structures.
Yeah, I feel like the listeners might just imagine like the actual skeletons, like a human
That's
skeleton.
That's what I'm imagining. Human microscopic human skeletons in my toothpaste.
I should give a couple of examples. So you can find anything from a meteorite section to starch.
How do you get hands on such unique materials, for example, as meteorites?
Yeah, that's a well-kept secret. Now, basically, you can get anything from everywhere.
Okay.
And some, like, for example, starch you can get from a potato.
Yeah, fair.
But that's yeah. quite, yeah.
Yeast you can just buy in the shop.
Yeah, but let's focus on the meteorite.
So one of the first mineral sections I got was when a geographical institute moved and they put everything in the bin and I collected all the sections from there.
Wow. Geological scavenger.
Exactly.
I love that. And that's where you found the piece, the sliced meteor. Wow. Okay, so we can find it's like a toy box. This book, like, we can find diatoms, which is something that I've just learned now. Meteorite slices,
and one of my favorites is the springtail, which lives in the earth anywhere where you sort of dig it up.
Right,
you can almost not see it. It's sort of a 0.1 to 1 millimeter,
okay,
and it has the most intricate skin you can have because it's has a special hexagonal structure,
huh.
Which is just, which I cannot show, but it's awesome.
Well, we trust you on that. But you also said like that you've been, for many things, these are that you published, many things you can find all around you. But what about your own body? Like, did you also include some things? I don't know, maybe like cut a hair or something like this.
Yeah, so for example, when I read into hair, a normal hair, just to get a... So the book is also about sort of teaching and conveying dimensions. So in the first part where they're crystallized, you have no dimensions, no scale bar. And then if you talk about a human hair, it's roughly about 70 micrometer. So then you have a reference for that. And then I soon afterwards learned that, of course, that's the average thickness of a hair, but it can range anywhere between 15 to 180, and which was actually a beard hair from some guy who made it in the Guinness Book of Records for it.
For the thickest beard.
For the thickest hair in his beard, almost 0.2 millimeters.
That's a unique collection you have there, honestly.
Wow.
So talking about my own body, one of my favorite images are red blood cells, which I've sort of gotten out of myself.
Don't do this at home.
Exactly. And keeping them 10 seconds in air, and that's when actually this fibrin network emerges, which...
That's when the blood clots, right?
Exactly, for a wound closure.
That's pretty cool. And then people actually can see what it looks like when they cut themselves and then the blood stops going.
Just a snippet what is in the book as images. So you can find anything which starts from your chewing gum having menthol to, as I said, meteorites, banknotes, and why you find cocaine on banknotes, blood vessels, different type of pollen, why you have hay fever, and you might now like it. Mosquitoes, obviously, for the Nordics, different type of microorganisms.
So it's basically Google on your shelf.
Exactly. Old school Google. So I also have a couple of hormones, but you need special licenses, and because obviously I wanted to have estrogen and testosterone, but you don't get big amounts of these legally.
Well, you can establish collaborations, or maybe somebody will approach you after.
Yeah, I mean, technically, it's very common for scientists to collaborate so that one can benefit from the other person's license. I think that I see that happening often, creating collaborations because one person is a pharmacologist and has like can have professional access to specific molecules and substances, and they collaborate together with someone else, and then, you know, they join resources.
So many images in the book have actually been produced just by me contacting a research group who works on something really funky, which caught my interest.
There you go. What's the weirdest thing that you had to contact another lab for?
The weirdest thing was actually like a coccolithic force, which is something you sort of almost dig up from the Mariana Trench.
Can you say that again? Sorry, a what?
Coccolithic force.
What is that?
Is it an animal? What are we talking about? Coccolithic. No, that sounds like a piece of stone.
Coccolithic force.
It sounds like chocolate, but I might be just hungry.
Then I don't think you can find that at the bottom of the Mariana Trench.
It's a calcium carbonate-based life form.
It's a life form. Okay, there you go.
It's a single-celled microalgae.
It's a microalgae. Okay, now we are looking at the picture, and I have no way to describe this, so I guess we'll beg Christopher to give us a picture and we can add it either in the description. There's no way I can describe that in words. Anastasia, I don't know if you want to give it a go.
But it looks beautiful. That's what we can tell you. For sure it looks beautiful.
And it makes up limestone.
It makes up limestone. So there are living things in limestone.
Or basically the skeletons have formed the limestone.
Of course, the skeletons. Oh, so I could find this skeleton of these things on my tap.
Now actually, if you see the cliffs of Dover, they're all made up of coccolithic force. The white cliffs of Dover.
That raises more questions to me right now.
We need a whole new episode for this.
I don't know. Exactly. Just reviewing the book page by page.
Exactly. That's the weird... Oh, wow. Okay. That's...
Well, it's actually also what you have been using if you're old enough to... What you use, the chalk you use to write on the...
Yes.
Blackboard.
No, don't tell me it's that. Don't tell me it's that.
Sort of a similar thing.
No, it's not, is it?
No, there are different ways to do it. But that is one, they form the basis to basically.
So you've covered so many different topics in your book, and you've looked at so many different things, especially the ones that relate to our nearby things. So has it really changed the perception of your everyday life?
So in essence, that the book is about, we live in a certain dimension which is available to everyone. However, there are more dimensions which sort of should make you as human also humble what you're influenced by. Because you obviously have a centralistic view as a human because of what you see, and which I'm saying is only 400 to 700 nanometers, and then something what you hear, and of course you have taste and touch. But then after that, it's interesting to see what else are you influenced by, and that you only partake in a bigger pictures, and that there is lots and lots still to be found, understood, and that nowadays this is sort of a thing also to have an exploratory way of doing research on common objects. And this is also why the book itself should work in the same explorative manner. So it has a large bibliography where you can sort of go through, pick up a word. They are expressly that you don't understand them and sort of start to learn something or find something, which means, I don't know what a macrophage is. So you can go to page 104 or 106 and you will find out what a macrophage is all about and how much knowledge there is. Because I also feel that today there is a lot of expertism. We live in a century where people say there are no facts, just opinions, pretty much influencing the political landscape. But on the other hand side, there is expertism. So if you break your leg, you're going to fix it. But if there is a vaccine, suddenly people don't listen anymore to people who sort of understand about things. And this is to convey that there is so much you don't understand. And it's a small research project on matters which I have been focusing into. And another thing is, I want to convey dimensions, what there is in the world, see behind things, and that there is an eagerness also to explore, not only to consume. Taking all these images sort of has shown me that all of these matters are connected, and that we are influenced by another sphere, and that we are limited to our perception. For example, as I said, by just being able to perceive light at 400 to 700, but there are so many other wavelengths and things we don't see. And so these other dimensions sort of make me humble and how I am placed, and that I'm just only partaking in a bigger picture on the planet. So the point was sort of to say, you know, that it's clear that what the concept is. So it's either a nice book, which works as an atlas where you can skim through, but it has a deeper meaning, and you can find many things and sort of dwell in it like you can when you go outside and find things and look at the tiniest things on the planet.
I think what you said was very beautiful. And before we move on to our fun fact for today, are you going to publish any other book, Chris? I mean, of course, now it's just been published, but are you already thinking further ahead?
The first itch I had after having this published was actually to do the next one. And the thing holding me back is that publishing and then distributing it is basically the same amount of work.
Mm.
But I would hope that somebody comes to me and say, we'll do the publishing part for you. Do you want to write another book? And then I'm happy to do so. And there is enough material to do so as well, image-wise.
May I just jump in here a little bit side note? Because we have now launched themes on our science basement. And I think that what you're presenting now here in the form of your book is a very good example of how, like, you can intersect your scientific research with something outside science, such as art and expanding knowledge and science communication. So I think it's a very good example of that.
Public outreach.
Public outreach, exactly. Expanding knowledge. Chris, now would you like to jump in with a fun fact?
It's fun fact time already.
Yeah, a couple of fun facts, like just sentences.
Okay.
Did you know that we excrete like 10 grams of salts every day in our urine? And that there is even a picture of it.
You had a picture of salt excreted by someone's urine. And when I asked you what's the weirdest thing, you went with the limestone one. We have different definitions of weirdest. But no, I mean, I didn't know it was 10 milligrams, but I could imagine there would be salt in the urine, yes.
Did you know that elephants can store up to 8 liters of water in their trunks, in the creases of their skin, and that what? They have hair which differs in lipid composition from any other animal?
I'm still coming to peace with the 8 liters. Wow.
Did you know humans have 46 chromosomes?
Yeah, I knew that. I'm a biologist. I knew that.
And how many does the male ant species have?
One?
One.
Oh!
And the unicellular protist Oxytricha triphalax has 15,600 chromosomes.
Now, what's the use of 15,600 chromosomes for a unicellular organism, really? Now, that is a waste of space.
That is true. Did you know that most mammals have a 1-to-40 brain-to-body ratio?
I did not know the exact number, but I know as a neuroscientist that that's a very important parameter, the brain-to-body ratio. But 1-to-40 in most mammals, okay.
Did you know that flies can lay up to 500 eggs in batches of 75 to 150 eggs over 3 to 4 days? Only a couple of weeks, they already exceed the whole human population.
I cannot say I knew that. No, that yeah. I'm slightly scared, but good.
Did you know that the maturation time of human sperm is 74 days? But that you produce 1,500 sperm cells per second.
So it takes 74 days for one sperm, or, you know, in parallel, a sperm, to fully develop and be ready to go. It takes 74 days. But we produce so many that we always have a full stock. Good to know.
It's a manufacturing factory.
Did you know that over 1 million seed species or seed samples have now been stored in the island of Svalbard?
Yes, I knew that. I did know that. Yes.
Sounds more like a questionnaire and or quiz now.
No, but I'm loving this. Like the science specimen trivia.
You know why insects were much bigger millions of years ago? Because there is a limit of gas exchange. And that's the reason why they cannot be bigger than 20 centimeters now. But millions of years ago, the largest dragonfly had like a wingspan of 1.5 meters.
Oh my God, that must be terrifying.
Because the oxygen concentration was 35% and not 21%.
So it would allow enough exchange for such a low surface to volume ratio, right?
Yeah. Did you know that cellular protrusions in the lung beat up to 20 times per second? And those are the ones you actually paralyze by smoking.
Oh, no, I did not know that.
Did you know that humans after birth have 300 bones fusing into 206 in adulthood?
Yeah. No, I knew that there are some bones that are fused. I heard of it. Sorry.
Yeah, no, of course.
You know what? I don't want to sound too like, oh, I did not know that, because I several times say in the podcast, in different episodes, I'm a biologist. So if I highlight how many things I don't know, I don't want to give the idea of people like, I'm a terrible biologist. I don't know basic stuff. So sometimes I'm like, yeah, I know that, obviously.
Okay, but then you must know how quickly nerve impulses travel.
Yes. I knew it when I was, because I remember studying this at university, but the number, I forgot it. I cannot remember the number.
Did you know that nerve impulses travel at speeds of up to 100 meters per second?
Yeah, it rings a bell. Yes. This is a value that I've studied at university.
Well, if anything, you just refreshed your memory now.
It refreshed my memory, yes.
One more fun fact for the neuroscientists. Did you know that cells in the brain have as many as 1 to 200,000 connections to each other? And that suggests that you might have as many as 1,000 trillion synapses, which is like 10,000 times more than all of our stars in this galaxy.
Yes, that is remarkably true. Yes. No, this is proper science communication, mate.
Wow.
Okay, I've learned so much today.
Yeah, I think the full episode was just full of fun facts.
Mind-blowing pictures.
And I think it's actually time to wrap up. And I think it's been a very lovely episode. And thank you, Chris, again very much for coming on today. It was an absolute pleasure. And for everybody who is listening, please check out the book. I'm sure it will be worth your time. And yeah, see you in the next episode. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
If you like this episode, give it a thumbs up, rate it on the podcast app of your choice, and don't forget to share it with your friends. This podcast was produced by The Science Basement, a science communication organization based in Helsinki, Finland. Interested in being involved or interviewed? Get in touch at the podcast@thesciencebasement.org.